We tend to think of microbes in terms of the parasites that make humans sick with things like the flu and measles, but what if beyond that, they also play a role in how we think, determining everything from whom we vote for to how we dress ourselves? Kathleen McAuliffe discusses the theory behind this hidden and possibly widespread connection in her latest book called This Is Your Brain on Parasites, How Tiny Creatures Manipulate Our Behavior and Shape Society. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased it has brought Kathleen McAuliffe to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
When you say parasite, I usually would think of something like tapeworms. How broad is the definition of a parasite? Are we talking viruses, bacteria?
Yes, I'm using the word parasite in the broadest scientific sense. So I am talking about pathogenic viruses, bacteria, and organisms that I think the layman typically associate, you know, thinks of as a parasite, like ticks and lice and leeches, that kind of thing.
And you're right, parasites have always been our worst enemy. Any historical examples you want to give other than things that most obviously come to mind?
Here's an extraordinary factoid. Half of all people who have ever lived, all people who've roamed this planet have died from malaria alone. So then you throw in things like smallpox and measles and dysentery and
the Black Plague.
Exactly. I mean, parasites have killed more people than all large predators and all wars combined.
Why, despite our thousands of years of battling parasites, are we still vulnerable to them? Do the parasites have a certain advantage?
They do indeed, because they have they replicate so rapidly. So they're constantly acquiring new mutations that allow them to penetrate our defense systems.
Despite the fact that we've evolved defenses against the infections.
That's right. I mean, we can't keep up as easily because we don't, reproduce as quickly. But as a result, we've developed another means of protecting ourselves from infection. And something that few people appreciate is that we possess a germ shield. It's called our behavioral immune system. And basically, as we're moving about our environment, we're constantly scanning our surroundings for contaminants like grimy fingerprints or, you know, Kleenex, crumpled up Kleenex. And when we spot them, that part of our brain triggers disgust and withdrawal from the threat.
The sort of thing that we feel when we see excrement or murky water. Those are protective reactions.
Exactly.
Aren't there some religious guidelines that were influenced by parasites, the Mosaic Laws, for example?
Yes, a Mosaic Law is basically any kind of religious doctrine derived from the teachings of Moses. And Judaism, of course, is based heavily on Mosaic Law, as is Christianity and Islam, which are offshoots. And Jewish doctrine is very protective against infectious disease, even early on.
Pork and trichinosis were instinctively linked, I guess. But even things like washing hands and bathing, I remember reading that during the Middle Ages, people thought Jews were practicing witchcraft because they weren't dying of the bubonic plague in the same numbers that Christians were, and it probably was simply because of bathing and covering wells and burying their dead quickly, all based on religious law.
Yeah, and they had many other, specific injunctions that protected against disease to the point where some people actually think of the Torah as one of the first medical textbooks. For example, Jews were instructed to boil eating utensils became dirty, they were supposed to boil them in water. They were never supposed to eat an animal that had been felled by natural causes. And, of course, those kind of animals may well have died of infectious disease. It's just enormous, the number of injunctions, early Jews were instructed not to let their daughters to become prostitutes, homosexuality, bestiality, sex outside of marriage, all were discouraged, if not, banned outright. They were even told, when it came to the spoils of war, Jews were instructed to take any metal booty and put it through the flame to basically sterilize it with heat. And if it couldn't be put through the flame, they were told to wash it with a mixture of ash and animal fat mixed in water, what they call purifying water, which is an early recipe for soap.
My guest is Kathleen McAuliffe, whose book is This Is Your Brain on Parasites, How Tiny Creatures Manipulate Our Behavior and Shape Society. We've been talking about their impact on us. What about the lives of parasites? You write, is it a difficult life?
People think it's an easy gig, right? Because, you get a free supply of nutrients, the freeloader's existence. But it's actually harder than you might imagine, because a lot of parasites have more than one host. And simply getting from one host to the next can be quite a logistical challenge.
And you're right about a kind of parasite that spends part of its life inside an ant, but can only reproduce inside the bile duct of sheep. Why would a parasite evolve to need two very different environments in order to survive?
No one knows the, complex evolutionary history that explains this very strange phenomenon. But yes, basically, the parasite has to get from the ant into a sheep. But, ants are not on a sheep's normal menu. So what this parasite does is it actually triggers the ant to, at nighttime when most of the other ants are returning to their colony, infected ants will climb a blade of grass, lock onto the blade of grass, and basically hang out there until a grazing sheep comes by and eats, the ant-laden blade.
So they've manipulated the ant. And if the sheep doesn't eat the ant, they go back down to the ant colony until the next day?
They do indeed, because if the ant remains locked onto that ant blade, it's going to, be fried to death in the bright light of day. So then it goes down, and then at the end of the day, it will return once the, sun sets.
And is this done through some kind of chemical reaction?
We don't understand all parasitic manipulations, but we do understand that one in particular. I don't know if we understand it at a molecular level, but there are a number of other parasitic manipulations that we do understand better.
Because we've been studying them?
That's right.
Because are we studying them to understand how they affect us, or just because this is interesting science?
Funny you should ask that question. There is one particular parasite called Toxoplasma. It's a one-celled protozoan, and it replicates inside the cat gut, and then the eggs of this parasite are deposited in its feces. Grazing rodents can pick up this parasite, and then it basically, by tinkering with the animal's neural circuits, it can make the animal sexually attracted to the scent of cat odor. Mm. And so, needless to say, these rodents are not long for this world, and soon they're back in the belly of a cat, which is exactly where the parasite wants to be. But this very same parasite can infect us. It's the reason pregnant women are told to avoid cat litter boxes.
You wrote a piece for The Atlantic in 2012 called How Your Cat Is Making You Crazy, about a man named Yaroslav Flager. Could you tell us a bit about his story?
Yes, he's a very eccentric biologist, and he's now like in his early 60s, but when he was in his 20s, he became obsessed with the idea that, there was just something wrong with him. Like, he just didn't seem to have normal fears. So he told me he would think nothing of walking out into dense traffic, and if a car honked to him, he wouldn't jump out of the way. Or once when he was in eastern Turkey with some friends of his, a battle broke out between the Kurds and the Turkish government. And as, bullets are whistling overhead, he took cover, but he was like, what is wrong with me? Why aren't I terrified? And for years he was, obsessed with this thought that he was different from other people. And then one day a colleague of his was having trouble gathering enough subjects for a study. This colleague was trying to develop an improved test for toxoplasma. So Yaroslav said, okay, he volunteered. And that's how he discovered he himself tested positive for the parasite. And then when he learned that the parasite invaded the brain and so on, he thought, hey, maybe that's the reason that I'm so strange.
So here's a scientist claiming parasites are controlling his brain. How did the scientific community react to those claims?
Well, I mean, in the early years, needless to say, I mean, it, you know, people thought, you know, he was kind of kooky. But over the years, a number of scientists were studying what exactly the parasite does to the rodent brain. And in addition to affecting, you know, there's how they respond to the scent of cats. In general, they found that the parasite tends to kind of be randomly distributed in the brain, and if it clusters in one place or another, it can change behavior. And infected rodents tend to be they're kind of emboldened, they are big risk takers, you know, they think nothing of going into, you know, wide open spaces where they're vulnerable to predation. So it's, you know, it occurred to people that, hey, maybe this parasite, you know, it's randomly distributed in our brains as well, and sometimes it clusters in certain places. Maybe it's affecting our behavior too.
So when I screw up, can I say a parasite made me do it?
Well, you can't absolutely prove it, but yeah, it's definitely
a good excuse.
It's certainly a novel excuse.
Do these subtle changes in human behavior brought on by the parasites directly benefit the parasites in any way?
Probably not, because, you know, we're a dead end for the parasite. But there is concern. I mean, we've long known that toxoplasma poses a danger to a developing fetus, or also people who are immune compromised. But it was generally thought that healthy people suffered no adverse consequences, that after the parasite invades your neurons, that it just settles down, it becomes a dormant infection, never again to bother you.
On the other hand, you suggest that a person who's infected with the rabies virus might exhibit signs of parasitic manipulation, that foaming at the mouth is part of something the parasites are forcing people to do?
What happens with the rabies virus, it's a very interesting case. The rabies virus enters through a wound, and it is almost unique among viruses in that it doesn't invade the bloodstream. It crawls along. It follows nerve tracks to your brain, so it moves at a really plodding pace of like an inch or two a day until it gets to your brain. And once it gets inside our brains, it begins madly replicating, and it invades a part of the brain that controls fundamental drives like anger, aggression, hunger, even sex drive. Like, it's not very well known, but an atypical but well-documented symptom of rabies is actually like a voracious appetite for sex.
Okay, the rabies virus made me do it. There's a photo in the book of a man putting a fistful of worms into his mouth, and the caption reads, "How revolted you are by this image strongly predicts whether you hold liberal or conservative political views." Liberals are more likely to accept that image than conservatives? Is that true?
If you consider what conservative thought, it's about a lot of behaviors that are very relevant to disease transmission. So, for example, conservatives tend to be more conservative in their sexual values. You know, they're fond of ideas like virginity pledges. Over our history, foreigners were more likely to expose us to exotic germs for which we had no natural defenses. So conservatives also tend to be more opposed to immigration.
Even though we almost annihilated the Native Americans by coming here and then claiming that we were the Americans. Forgive me for thinking about irony.
Yeah.
But can an explanation also be that conservatives are on the average older than liberals? Not always, of course. So they might be more vulnerable to parasites?
Well, conservatives are more disgust sensitive, and disgust is an emotion that evolved to protect us from parasites. So, and it's a little known fact that they tend to be more squeamish. So, if you showed, as you asked me, when you show people really disgusting imagery, like someone swallowing worms, a conservative, for example, will sweat more profusely as measured by galvanic skin response.
You asked Flager whether one can guess from observing someone whether he or she is infected by a parasite. And what was his answer?
He said that he'd have to, that he can't tell you for any one individual, that he can only detect differences between fairly large groups of people. So he'd need to, you know, look at least 50 people or more before he might detect slight differences. Among other things, he's found that people who are infected have slightly slower reaction times, and they also seem to be less risk adverse. And one sort of interesting finding is several different countries that they found that people who are infected are more likely to be in car accidents. Maybe because they have lowered vigilance, I don't know, or they don't respond as quickly to conditions on the road. Nobody really knows why. But
we're not going to say that everybody who's in a car accident or has certain of those other qualities has been infected. So your guess is as good as mine?
I mean, this is all correlational data. So, you know, we really have to be cautious about that. We can't prove that this is causality. I think that scientists take this seriously simply because they can see in rats exactly, you know, what happens. They can see when the parasite clusters in certain parts of the brain, they can see that the behaviors of the rodent change.
You've said that they can affect our religion, our politics. If parasites' influence reaches so far into human civilization to affect religion and politics, how do we address free will?
That's a really good question. I have to say, in the course of researching this book, it did really start to make me wonder whether we don't overestimate, you know, the degree to which we're really in control of, you know, our thoughts and feelings and even our political views.
Well, the parasites are forcing me to end this segment because we've run out of time. But my great thanks to Kathleen McAuliffe for coming by to talk about her book, This Is Your Brain on Parasites, How Tiny Creatures Manipulate Our Behavior and Shape Society. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. It's been a pleasure having you here.
A pleasure. It was mine.